spent most of the week talking about these fully connected feed-forward neural networks, although I should have emphasized that it turns out that a lot of what we talked about last week is actually more generally applicable in neural networks. So a lot of what we saw about activation functions and cost functions, training algorithms, a lot of that's going to be used in outside of supervised learning and outside of feed-forward neural networks as well. Although in all the code we looked at and the applications, we were mostly talking about where we can use these feed-forward networks. So today is the last lecture where we'll talk about supervised learning, and we're going to talk about a more sophisticated structure of neural networks called convolutional neural networks. And so I've just written here a few words that we're going to explain, or a few expressions that we're going to explain throughout the lecture. So by the end of today, I think you'll be able to give definitions of local receptive fields, what it means to share weights and biases, and the concept of pooling. I think that will be clear. And then we'll do a tutorial on CNNs tomorrow. Ideally, it would have been today, but there were some other things scheduled for the PSI students this afternoon. So just note that the tutorials this week are maybe going to be delayed by a day or two just because of the way the schedule worked. So tomorrow's tutorial really goes with today's lecture. So as I kind of said last week, what we looked at were networks where we had multiple layers. The number of layers was some hyperparameter that we considered, and we had different numbers of neurons in every layer. But the key point that I want to emphasize is that every neuron in a given layer was connected to every neuron in the next layer. And so one issue that arises with this kind of structure, where every neuron is connected to every neuron in the next layer, is that we're not exploiting some physical properties that we might expect to have, whether it be in a physical system or in an image that we would see. We might expect to have things like locality or translational invariance in a lot of images or systems that we would study, but that's not a property of these networks. We would have to learn it. So, as I said, we would expect that lots of the images we would study or the systems like the Ising model configurations would have properties like locality, and a lot of them also have translational invariance. So what that means is if we use networks like this, we lose that kind of spatial information about what features are local, what interactions in an image or what pixels in an image are close. So maybe we can learn that, but we could imagine that could be difficult to learn. And if we know that for sure, that we have this locality, maybe we want to consider a network where we just put it in from the beginning. So let's just consider a little example. Let's say we're looking at a 4x4 image. And just to emphasize, a lot of these techniques that we talk about for our applications in many-body physics, they also apply to image processing. So it doesn't really matter right now if I'm talking about a picture of a dog or some Ising spin configuration. Kind of the same idea applies. So we know that what we've been doing in the tutorials when we've been having these images, our convention was to kind of label the pixels by or the sites by going from left to right and then up the rows. But then we saw that we're kind of going to lose all of this two-dimensional structure when we put this kind of image as input to a feed-forward neural network. So we're just kind of going to put the information of our pixels in as a 1D array. But a problem here is that we know that say, in this example, pixels 3 and 4 should be close to each other, but 4 and 5 are actually not very close. So what this means is that features of locality, of maybe which pixels or which sites might influence each other or be more correlated, that's easily lost. And we would need to train our network to learn that itself. So the solution that convolutional neural networks use, or one of the solutions that you can use to kind of improve these locality features and preserve them, is to introduce something called local receptive fields. But before I talk about that, are there any questions so far about kind of why these initial networks we looked at have these problems with locality? Is it clear? Okay. So what these fields do is that they process our data kind of in patches. So they're going to kind of look at a local patch of our data that's going to take into account the dimensionality that we know we have. So let's look at an example again. We'll just take our 4x4 system that we were considering before. And so instead of writing it as a length 16 array, let's keep it as a 2x2 structure. And this is this will be our input to our network. And then rather than just connecting every neuron to the next one, let's kind of look at one patch at a time. So this guy. So I haven't really given you the formula for how this works yet, but the idea is that we're going to, in order to get this neuron in our next layer, it's going to take as input just kind of some local patch from the previous layer. It's not going to take all of the neurons from that previous layer. And in this case, the patch that we're looking at is just a 2x2 square. But of course, we can look at more general patches. So we can see with this specific example that I drew, we started out with input that was size 4x4. And if I were to apply these kind of patches at every possible location, as I shift that square around my image, I would get a set of neurons in the next layer of size 3x3. So of course, this is not the only way that I can apply this type of transformation. I can generalize this. So anyone have ideas of something I could do that's more general than just applying a 2x2 square? There's a few different things we can do. It would be similar, but maybe a bit different.
A rectangle?
A rectangle, yeah. Or maybe even another shape, right? Doesn't even have to be a rectangle. Yeah, but great, yeah. So. So you could imagine that maybe we know that our data is more correlated in the x direction than the y direction or something like that. There could be situations where we want to look at a rectangular patch instead. Or maybe for some reason we want to look at a circular patch or something like that. We can do that. Another thing we can do, so one thing you might notice if we're looking at images, if we look here, we'll see that the pixels on the edge are only going to get considered by, in this case, this one will only get considered by one patch. And ones on the edge will get considered by two patches. But ones in the middle will get considered by more different patches that slide around. So what we could do is we could put zeros around the edge of our image just so that the pixels on the edge get considered more often. And maybe that allows us to consider the edges in a slightly better way. So I just tried to draw there what I mean. We take our initial image, which is size L by L, and we just add some zeros along the edge before we start processing. Another thing that we can do is we can introduce a stride. And all that really means is that we don't have to apply this square or this circle or this shape. We don't have to apply it everywhere. We could take a step before we apply it. So a stride is kind of our step size before we apply this patch again. Okay. So in the initial example, I would kind of take all possible patches that I can. But in this example, instead of spacing them by one, I'm going to space them by two. And so you can see that, of course, depending on how I choose my patches, my padding, and my stride, I'll have a different size of neurons in my a different number of neurons with a different shape in my next layer. So if I start with an image that has length L, then at the next layer, I'm going to have L1 neurons. And the way I calculate L1 is just in terms of these three different parameters. Okay, and then one thing that's important, maybe it's not usually that important for image processing, but in the systems that we're going to look at, it's important that we often want to consider periodic boundary conditions. So in this case, in cases where we have periodic boundaries, we probably wouldn't want to pad our image with zeros, but instead we would want to kind of wrap our image on a torus and kind of consider sliding these patches all the way across the edge and wrapping back around. Does it make sense?
Yeah, he just was saying it would make a weird dog if you put it on.
It would, yeah. So in that case, if we have periodic boundary conditions, we really just have to consider how much stride that we're taking before we apply our filter. Any questions so far? Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to talk about this, but how do you deal with having multiple channels in your data,
Yeah, that's the next thing we're going to talk about. Yeah, good question. Yeah, so the question was, what do you do if you have different channels in your data? So what that means is, if you had an image, for example, you'd have RGB channels for the different colors. And actually, we'll get to it in just a second. We're also going to see that in our gauge theory configurations, we also kind of naturally have different channels. So we'll talk about that just now. Okay, so really, rather than just having an input that just has x and y coordinates, we can introduce another channel index. So these images wouldn't really just be 4x4. Maybe they'd be 4x4 times 3 if we have 3 channels. So 4x4 times some depth.
Channels are unrelated to the step size, right?
Yes. So, yeah, in my notes it's more clear. I meant this S to be a capital S,
okay.
And this is a lowercase, but maybe we can use C here, but just remind me, because in my notes it's an S, and so if I make a mistake, just like call it out. So let's call that C. Yeah, but thanks for pointing that out. That would be, yeah, that's a little confusing. And when I have like lined paper, you know, the uppercase is way bigger, but
yeah.
It's not so obvious on the board. So, as I said, for our images, C, this number C, it can label our RGB channels. And when we're talking about spin configurations, we're going to use it to label the sublattices, actually. So we can kind of think of a concept of kind of like a unit, what do we call this? I'm just missing an obvious word. But anyway, we can think of X and Y as kind of defining the sites of kind of our typical square lattice. And then C is going to encode the more of the details of our lattice in terms of sublattice. Unit cell, that's what I was. Okay. And so for every time that you apply a patch or a filter, we're going to call that a filter, the size is actually going to be your patch size. So if it's a square, just L patch times L patch. And then you have a third dimension for your number of channels. I forget. Can you guys tell me where you can see up to? I want to label it. Can you see up to here? And like down here you can still see? Sort of? Like, but over here it's getting bad? At what point can you not see?
Like lower than that, I can't see. Yeah.
Oh, just down here.
I can't see that.
Oh, okay. So it's not that bad. I'll like avoid.
Yeah, it depends where you're sitting, right?
Okay. Well, I'll raise it anyway, but. So let's think back to our example of the icing gauge theory that we saw last week. Because there, we didn't just have our spins living on sites of a square lattice. They were really living on the bonds. So it's hard to just kind of decompose this simply into a square lattice of pixels like I would in this second board here, where I just composed it into this grid like that. So there, it's kind of much easier to think of two sublattices.
Nice.
where the open circles are on sublattice 1 and the squares are on sublattice 2. And then so that means for every coordinate x and y, we have to consider two values of c, this sublattice or channel index. So I'll raise this board just to make sure you can see it. So if I kind of just think of one little piece of my lattice that I've drawn here, so to the sites of kind of my underlying square lattice, I can just associate these coordinates x and y in a simple way that will allow me to tile in just a square lattice manner. But then every time I have an xy coordinate, I have to think of c equals 1 and c equals 2. So we're going to use the same code that we would use to process different channels, different colors of images. But in our cases, when we look at the tutorial tomorrow for this ice and gauge theory, the channels are going to be these sublattices. Any questions?
Okay.
Yeah?
So how would you explore the symmetries in the original data?
Yeah, so we haven't really talked, all we've really exploited so far is locality. But right now we're going to talk about how to exploit, for example, translational invariance. So that's going to be the next thing. Yeah. Seems like these questions were planted today. This is great. Yeah, Katie?
And then are you just averaging the data?
In where?
When you coarse grain it, do you just take an average of the values on each patch?
So the coarse graining we haven't talked about yet. Coarse graining, well, I was calling coarse graining this pooling step, and I haven't introduced that yet. So far, all I've kind of said is that we're tending to look at these patches of data. But I haven't done any coarse graining really yet, I wouldn't say. Yeah, in the next layer, maybe sometimes the size is a little bit smaller, but I don't think it's really a coarse graining. But you'll see it in that's coming up too. Okay, so in order to exploit properties of translational invariance, what we can do is we can introduce shared weights and biases. So what do I mean by that? So what this basically means is that as I apply these filters to these patches, I can ensure that I actually apply the same filter everywhere. So I'll basically just slide. I can think of sliding the same filter all along my image, along x and y, but not actually changing the weights and biases associated with that filter. so as a result of doing this, then when I apply a convolutional layer to my data, I'm going to have translational invariance in that transformation. So we can kind of, just to make this very clear, we can think of these shared weights as similar to the shared couplings that we would often have in an icing model. So if we have an icing model with periodic boundary conditions and we don't change the coupling, we would expect to have translational invariance in this system. And so in the same type of way, we would probably expect that it would make sense to have some shared weights as we also translate across the x and y coordinates. So I'm going to start a new board because I want to write a bigger formula. So another thing that I haven't really said yet is that maybe we don't want to apply just one filter at every layer. Even though we want to, every time we apply a filter, we want to slide it everywhere. Maybe one filter is kind of looking for one type of feature, but we might need to use more than one to ensure that we're kind of looking for all the features that we might need. So just as before, we're still propagating information from left to right, just as in the fully connected feed-forward networks. So still, we're going to be getting our output. We're going to be calculating what we get at layer L from layer L minus 1. It's just we're doing it in a more special way now. Thank you. Okay, so this is the formula that we're going to use now to calculate the output from our neurons at layer L. And so it actually looks quite similar to what we saw last week. We still have an activation function here. And we're still looking at our output from the previous layer and applying weights to it and then adding a bias. It's just that we're applying these weights in more of this special patch-like way. So let's just look at this weight matrix to make sure we understand what all these four indices are. Sorry, C. I put S because it's what's in my notes, but it should be C. Okay, so one of these is going to correspond to our x coordinate, so sliding along the x direction. So it's going to kind of index which x coordinate we're applying our transformation to, our filter. And then in addition to these spatial indices, I have to have this channel index, since the input from the previous layer can have a channel or a sublattice index. And then I also need to label my different filters. So maybe I'm not just going to use one. I'm going to use NF filters. So I have to have one three-dimensional tensor for every different filter. Yeah.
So the way that you've written that formula over there, the subscripts on AL minus 1, you have AX plus M minus 1, Y plus N minus 1. So for your neuron XY in layer L, you're taking the values from the neurons. I mean, it doesn't matter. What I'm trying to say is, like, it would be, we would like, for example, that if our L patch is 3, then we would want AXY to be like X minus 1 to X plus 1 and Y minus 1 to Y minus 1.
Yeah, it kind of just depends how you label it. I guess with the convention I was using, I was labeling like the corner of it rather than the middle. But yeah, you could totally adopt a different labeling if you wanted it to be.
Maybe it doesn't matter.
I think just the way you're saying, there could be cases where your x and y are not just integers. So the question is basically, why do we choose to label in this way? Maybe we would like to have it so that when we're applying a patch, we're applying it right in the middle, so that the x, you know, the x and y coordinate associated with this neuron would be right in the middle. But I'm just saying that that's not really how we've defined this. We've defined it kind of to be in the corner. And yeah, I think maybe there's some cases where people would prefer to do it the way you're saying. I just think that then, yeah, as I said, your x and y coordinates, they, in many cases, they might be like, you know, halfway in between two integers or something, right? And so maybe that can get confusing. So I think maybe it's just a bit more straightforward to label one of the corners.
Sure. Yeah, I just, I guess maybe it's just a matter of thinking about the structure of the network. Because like when we add padding, right, the purpose of padding could be, for example, so that our next layer will have the same number of neurons as our previous layer.
That's right.
I don't know. For me, it's easier to think about if we're indexing it from the center of the cell, and then we.
So with the padding, I guess I don't even know if you would have that with padding though, because if I imagine my image and then I've added some padding to it, maybe in some cases you're gonna pad such that, I have to draw this a bit better. You might pad such that like one filter is just like just barely touching this corner, and then that would be like over here too, right? I don't think it would quite have the feature that you're saying.
Okay.
Yeah, so I do see what you're saying, and maybe I think it doesn't matter so much. Like if you want to rewrite this formula in a way, or we can think about together how to rewrite it, in a way that it's in the center, if that makes more sense to you, I think it's fine. It's just in the code, maybe we just have to think about how to actually write it in a way in the code that makes more sense, that's not
it's just
too confusing.
Index in the end, so it doesn't matter. But, in terms of the intuition for what's going on, but anyway, I'll ask you about it later.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, maybe we can talk later in case I'm not fully understanding your question. Yeah.
What if you want filters of different sizes?
If you want, okay, so if you don't want just squares?
Or you want to change L patch depending on K.
Change L patch depending on K. So K is my
size.
Oh, I see. That's cool. Yeah, so then, right. So then I guess your weight matrix, like right now this weight matrix, as I've drawn it, it's like L patch by L patch by NC by NF. But I think if we wanted to do what you're saying, then it wouldn't just be hyper rectangular, right? It would have like different, this size would be different for every filter. But you could do that, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I've kind of just written the square case here. I mean, the most trivial thing I guess you could do is that here you could have different X and Y sizes of your patches. You could easily just add that in. The reason I'm kind of writing it in this way is because in the tutorial tomorrow, this is the form that you're going to use. But yeah, you can definitely make this more general. Right now, this is, of course, just square too, right? If we wanted some circular patch, we would have to modify this as well. Any other questions? Okay. So one thing I want to mention that with this weight sharing, what this tends to mean is that these networks are going to have far fewer parameters than we would have in our feed-forward neural networks. I mean, of course, I can always ramp up this number of filters so that that's not the case. But we remember that when we looked at our feed-forward networks, we were going to have one weight for every connection between every neuron to the next one. Whereas here, a lot of those weights are shared. So that means we don't have as many parameters to tune. I mean, we can easily design networks with fewer parameters to tune. So just to emphasize that training these networks can be very difficult because they have so many different free parameters. So it's a very difficult task to find a good solution. And as we saw last week, it's difficult to make sure we don't get stuck in local minima that are not very good solutions. And so these convolutional neural networks tend to have much fewer free parameters, so weights and biases that they need to learn during training. And that means we can often apply them for larger inputs, so larger image sizes, and deeper layers compared to the fully connected feed-forward networks. Of course, that's assuming that the input has translational invariance and locality, because otherwise, this is not really a very good type of transformation to apply. Any questions?
In the Z2 gauge theory, the crucial information is sort of non-local, right? Like the topological sector depends on.
That's right. But so yeah, in some sense, it's you're right that if we wanted to calculate these Wilson loops, that would be non-local. But also another thing we know about that Ising gauge theory is that we have to have a local constraint always satisfied, right? We have to have every plaquette having an even number of upspins and an even number of downspins. So if you think of these filters as looking for that constraint rather than looking for the Wilson loops, then I think they actually are a really good fit for that type of network.
Jordan?
Yeah.
I have a related question. Mm-hmm. So we talked about the translational symmetry,
yeah,
which I guess you could call like a space-time symmetry. Okay. But what if there's a symmetry, you know, the internal symmetry between the channel indices?
Yeah, I thought you might ask that, because like, I know you're interested in all of these different symmetries. Yeah, so a symmetry between the...
So if, say, we have two channel indices, so every data point is a matrix, and that matrix has a certain symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just a symmetric matrix, for example.
Right. Well, so I guess I don't know off the top of my head like exactly what it would look like. It would depend on the symmetry. But in this case, you know, we're having, for every filter, we're having L patch by L patch times NC free parameters. So I think you would just have fewer free parameters, right? You would have to design some filter that has that symmetry probably, and it would correspond to a fewer number of free parameters than this, what I've drawn.
So in this case, for example, you could center a filter at a node and then have the filter respect the local Z2 transformation where, you know, flipping each spin.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I think you could do that for sure. Yeah, the code we look at tomorrow doesn't actually do that, but you could try to implement that. Yeah, that's neat.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, although, I mean, not all configurations we look at have that symmetry. Like some of them have more up and down spins, so maybe that doesn't matter.
So.
Oh, but you mean it's invariant? Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Invariant.
Although the problem is that if you flip everything on one plaquette, it can affect the neighboring plaquettes too, right? So you only have this invariance if you apply like a Wilson loop across the whole system. Like if I have this system like this, and if I initially it's like this, so this plaquette is ordered. If I flip everything here, then all of a sudden this plaquette's not ordered, this one's not ordered.
Mm.
So you actually need to apply transformations on a square like this in order to have invariance. So maybe you can incorporate that somehow. I'm sure you can. I just don't know exactly how you do it. But yeah, if you always flip, let's go back to the initial case. So now this one is ordered. If I were to flip everything connected to here, so I flip like this, then I don't change which plaquettes are ordered and which ones.
Yeah, that's what I mean. If your filter was centered at a node.
I see.
Yeah,
you could probably do that for sure. Yeah, and then you could reduce your number of filters by a factor of two or something. Yeah, that's a really good idea. Yeah. Although, like in our code, we're not necessarily going to tell the system what these filters are, right? It's going to learn on its own. We're hoping that it's going to learn what they have to be. But yeah, you could imagine some model that you coded by yourself where you actually specify the filters, and then you'd probably want to have as few as possible.
The gauge symmetry is included in the architecture, essentially, the network, right?
Yeah. You mean you want to see if this network can learn the gauge symmetry?
No. But if you hard code the gauge symmetry into the filter, then
yeah. I'm sure you can imagine that. Yeah. Totally. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about before I just quickly show you a little thing on the computer is the idea of pooling. So what we can imagine doing after we apply a convolution is to apply some kind of a coarse graining transformation, which of course is going to lose information. But in cases where maybe these filters identify a lot of the same features, so there's a lot of high correlations or redundant information, it's going to be more efficient for us if we do some kind of coarse graining procedure. So let me draw it to make it more clear what I mean. So what I really mean here is we take our output from our convolutional transformation. And again, we kind of look at something that we're going to do in patches, so some pooling that we'll do in patches. And so things that we might do. Is maybe we're just going to take the maximum. So we can kind of think of our convolution as applying filters that look for different features. And maybe we just want to look where we got the maximum signal for that feature. So again, we're losing information, but maybe this will let us train more efficiently by doing something like this. So of course, we can do many different things, but here are just three options. So the first one, it's used very often, max pooling, where you would just take the maximum signal you got from all of your neurons after your convolution. The next, you could take the average signal or maybe the majority rule. So the idea is that under doing this transformation, of course, we're losing information, but it can make training a lot faster. And so in a lot of cases, people will do this. Kind of whether or not you apply pooling and in what way and in what size of patch, it's another hyperparameter that you have to think about in your training. And that can depend a lot on the nature of your data. But it's something that people often do. So another point I just want to emphasize is that usually we're going to do this pooling separately for each channel or for each filter. So we don't usually want to do coarse graining across different channels. Maybe there's some applications where you would, but usually people are just going to do this in the X and Y directions. Yeah, question.
Do people ever pool in like some layers, but then like unpool.
So I think unpooling is very difficult, right? Because you're trying to get more information. Like you're here, we're kind of taking four numbers and going to one.
Yeah.
But you're kind of saying to get four numbers from one.
Well, I mean, if you hold on to your like individual label information, then maybe you could.
Okay, so if you. If you somehow held on to the kind of weights associated with this transformation and tried to undo it. So actually, I mean, last year, one of the PSI students tried for his essay project, he tried to do something similar. He basically tried to see if machine learning could learn inverse renormalization group, which is basically, I think, what you're saying, like trying to, instead of getting smaller sizes from bigger ones, try to get bigger sizes from smaller ones. And there's, of course, like there's restrictions on how you can do that. But I guess you're saying actually like implementing the same weights and then doing some transformations and then like kind of undoing them. I think you can try to do that. I think there's some applications that kind of incorporate that same spirit of ideas. We might talk about some of them like next week when we talk about generative modeling. Yeah, that's a good idea. One last thing I wanted to say is that in a lot of cases, what you'll do is you'll do a convolutional layer followed by some pooling, then maybe some more convolutional layers. And then often you'll still do some fully connected layers at the end of your network. But you'll have far fewer neurons by the time you get to that point. So there still won't be as many parameters because you won't be starting with your very large input space. You'll kind of have used this to go down to some smaller number of neurons. And then you'll do the fully connected layers. OK, so quickly, I'd just like to get the screen down and show you guys. It'll just take 2 minutes, just a couple of pictures that are hard to draw myself with CNNs. Hopefully someone's listening to put the screen down.
Yes,
perfect. So this picture, I mean, I basically drew this for you, but I just think it's really nice to think of this this weight being applied in more of kind of a three-dimensional picture. So the blue is kind of my input image, and then the green picture there is kind of what I would get in the next layer. And you can see that they're applying this filter, this gray filter, sliding across the whole image. In this case, they have a padding of 2. And it's filling in these different elements of the neurons in the next layer. So again, this is not anything new, but I just thought this picture was nice. And I just wanted to show you in case you found my pictures a bit confusing, because I can't draw in 3D this well. The last thing I wanted to say is that convolutional networks, they tend to be very good at detecting more and more complex features as you move through the layers of your network. So because we're specifically looking for local features. If you're looking at images of people, for example, it tends to be that in the first few layers, you would detect things like edges, which are very, very local features. And then as we go on, we kind of combine those local features to detect things like ears or eyes or noses. And then finally, we would be detecting faces. So this is not something that's rigorously true, or that it doesn't have to be that the first layer is edges and the second layer is noses or something like that. But just as you move from left to right, you tend to see that your CNN is describing more and more complicated features. Do you guys have questions about that? So actually, there's a lot of people think about whether it makes sense to use these really deep networks in physical systems where you have scale invariance. Because if you have scale invariance, you don't really expect to see different features at different scales, right? So it's kind of whether we would actually be describing different physics. We would kind of expect to see the same features at every level if we have scale invariance. And just one last thing, which I'll let you guys play with on your own, but I just wanted to show you. There's this really nice website. And what they do is they take an image and they just let you apply different filters to it. So here's just an image here. And then there's different filters we can apply. So see, the sharpen filter, they call that this one. And then they show you what happens. So you can yourself slide this filter along the image and see how it's going from the input to the output here. And then down here, they also do it for maybe a more high resolution picture. And it kind of maybe helps you develop some intuition for why you would choose different kinds of filters. So a blur filter, for example, it puts weight on all of the different pixels in your previous layer and kind of averages them in some sort of way, so your picture is blurry. Other ones, the emboss one, it's kind of neat. So the emboss one, it kind of emphasizes differences between pixels along a vertical line, diagonal line, sorry. And that ends up giving you this kind of effect in your image. So I think it's just, I'll post this link online, and maybe if you guys want, it just helps to gain some intuition of how these filters work when applied to images. And there's, of course, lots of other websites that do really cool things, but this is just one I happened to come across. I also wanted to note that I updated the references over the weekend because someone had asked a question about how some of these proofs work in Monte Carlo about proving that you converge the Boltzmann distribution, which I didn't have time to prove. So I put up a link to where you can find that proof. And also you can read more about Monte Carlo method. So I added that reference and I'll add this one just after the class. Okay, so again, the tutorial related to these convolutional networks will be tomorrow afternoon. There's no tutorial today. And tomorrow we'll start talking about unsupervised learning.